And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 100.5 FM.
Indigenous women make up one-third of the federal prison population, yet they are only 4% of the general population. A recent report on the situation for women in federal prison calls this a crisis. It goes on to say that the experience of Aboriginal women in federal penitentiaries has been a continuation of the marginalization experienced by generations of Aboriginal women. The 62-page report, Marginalized, was prepared by the Wesley Group and recently released by Public Safety. This morning, we're joined by Kim Pate. Kim is Executive Director of the Elizabeth Fry Society, and we've reached her in Ottawa. Hello, Kim.
Good morning, Sean.
How can we make sense of the disproportionate numbers of Native women in prison? Why do so many of them end up being incarcerated?
Well, we're dealing with generations of colonization, and many of them have been directly were in residential schools themselves. Some have been certainly their families, their mothers, their fathers, their grandparents, and generations have been. And many of them have also been in the child welfare system, and there are a number of reasons, but one of them is that we see the impact of that institutionalization of a people. And disproportionately, those who have been most marginalized, most dispossessed, are the women. They're more likely to end up in the system, largely because so many other systems have been eviscerated, or they have not been able to obtain the support or assistance that they may need. So let me give you some examples. About 91% of the Aboriginal women in prison in federal custody serving 2 years or more have histories of abuse. The reality is they're not protected. We see the retreat of the state, the lack of protection when it comes to their experiences of violence, and yet we see them essentially deputized then to protect themselves, and when they do act to protect themselves or their children, they often end up criminalized in prison. So if we have many examples of situations where women have gone to, whether it's social services, healthcare, educational services, and certainly the criminal justice system, seeking support and assistance, not been provided with it, and yet the minute they act to then support themselves, whether it's by trying to make money in a way that's not considered legal because they're trying to negotiate poverty, whether it's because they're trying to anesthetize themselves to the reality of the abuse that they've experienced, which they haven't been supported to either be protected from in the first place or to deal with, then they may get criminalized because they're using drugs or alcohol. But they may get criminalized because they're selling their bodies to try and make ends meet. They may get criminalized because they're recruited to carry packages across town, across borders, that sort of thing. And we see increasing numbers right across the country, as we've seen cuts to social services in particular over the last couple of decades. We now have criminally low social assistance rates throughout this country, and so we've created an infinitely criminalizable group, and we know that women are more likely to be reliant on those services because the wage gaps, the education levels have often not been, that women haven't had the same opportunity, particularly if they're Indigenous women. So we see, just as there are not easy answers to the issues of why we're seeing more and more people being more dispossessed in a very rich country. Well, in some ways, there are easy answers. We don't see adequate sharing of income. We don't see adequate social services, healthcare, education services. And so those who have the least are more likely to end up on the streets, in institutions, criminalized and in prisons and or dead. And so we see that as, you certainly see it in the area that your offices, your studio is in Vancouver. You see it very clearly every day, I'm sure, as you're going in and out of your studios. And we see it right across the country. And so because we have not shored up or developed those support services for women, for young people, for poor people, for Indigenous people, for other racialized people, for those who have the least, we're more likely to see the catchment system be the criminal justice system. It's the only one that can't say we don't have we can't take you, our beds are full, you don't fit our mandate, on and on. And so we're literally seeing people being dumped into a system very easily. And, you know, some people will say, have said to me just this past week, I was speaking, and someone said, well, you know, they wouldn't go to jail if they didn't commit criminal offenses. And my response is, there's not a person, there are, you know, very few people who don't self-report that they themselves have done things for which, if it was reported, if they were prosecuted, they could in fact be criminalized. And so the reality is, we know that it's not because of anything in particular that Indigenous people do, but it is a function of the increased focus on problematizing those individuals for whom we don't provide the support and the services that should be in the community.
Kim, what happens to these women when they end up in prison? Does prison help to break or perpetuate the cycle of violence?
Well, unfortunately, no. I mean, women who are often having to survive on the street, their acts of resistance are the very things that will also lead them to be classified as higher security in the prison. We know that the classification scheme is discriminatory to start with, and that's one of the things the public safety report also talks about, the fact that they recognize the processes, the entire system is discriminatory in the way that it treats Aboriginal people in general, but particularly Aboriginal women. And when they end up in the system, they're all more likely to be classified as higher security. They're also more likely to have pled guilty to many of the charges they faced, and instead of ending up with their charges being bargained down, as often happens in many cases, and it's almost an expectation in the system. So they're often charged high, end up with longer sentences, end up in the system for longer periods of time, are less likely to be released in the community, less likely to have their needs met in the prison, and horribly and paradoxically, particularly if they come in with mental health issues, are likely to see those mental health issues exacerbated. If they don't come in with mental health issues, they may very well develop them inside, because they're more likely to be kept in the more isolated conditions. And so we see, you know, a situation where the Parliamentary Budget Officer has indicated that it costs approximately $343,000 a year to keep one federally sentenced woman in prison, when we realize that that's the cost, the financial cost, and we know that the human cost is a third of the women serving federal sentences are Aboriginal women, and we know that many of the communities from which they come or where their families originate are communities that are not well-resourced. Imagine what we could be doing with those resources if we instead refuse to have them put into prisons, refuse to have them put into a system that is about controlling and punishing them, as opposed to something that would provide a greater chance that they would enjoy some substantive equality and be able to participate in community, be educated, have their health care needs met, have an adequate livable income, have adequate housing, have drinkable water, all of the things that we know are too often lacking on many of the reserves. And
so it sounds kind of paradoxical. On the one hand, we have what you termed earlier a retreat of the state, but we also seem to have, in another aspect in terms of the prisons, an advance of the state almost.
Absolutely, a huge intrusion of the state in terms of intrusive and controlling social control types of mechanisms, but not in terms of supportive mechanisms that allow people to achieve their own potential and to be able to support themselves and be thriving, contributing members of their communities, their communities of choice, their families, however they define that. And it's certainly also linked to some of the work that's being done by so many of the incredible women doing anti-violence work and the Indigenous women's groups around the missing and murdered Aboriginal women. It's no accident that we see a lack of attention except very recently, basically a lack of attention for many years to the situation of violence, the crisis of violence that women have been and children have been experiencing in Indigenous communities. We've seen very little attention until Cindy Blackstock and and others have brought attention to the fact that so many young people on reserves don't even have access to education or drinkable water and or adequate health care. And so instead of focusing on developing those resources, we've seen in, you know, successive governments, federal, provincial, and territorial, focus on more prisons, more longer sentences, and basically setting people up to be in a much more difficult situation long term.
When women enter, Aboriginal women enter the prisons, what happens to them? What harms? Because earlier you mentioned mental health. Some women who don't have mental health problems once they're in prison, they seem to develop mental health problems. What exactly is happening to women once they're in prison?
Well, some women, if they're at lower security, will have access to some of the services that have been set up by different community groups. But the majority of the women, Aboriginal women, end up classified as higher security. In fact, in any one time, anywhere from 40 to 60% of the women classified as maximum security in a prison will be Indigenous. And so in the Prairie region in particular, we saw some of the first double bunking in maximum security and in segregation of women, particularly in Indigenous women. You're not likely to get access to many services when you're in that situation, nor many ceremonies if you're trying to engage in traditional healing practices with elders. In addition, we see incredible rates of self-injury. I mean, some of the research just released a few weeks ago in the Prairie shows that the rate has increased some 26 times for Indigenous women, the rate of self-harm. And so women slashing, women, headbanging, attempting suicide. And so we're seeing significant issues around the hopelessness and the crisis in terms of what will happen even when those individuals start to try and reenter the community, if they do, if they survive prison, when they survive prison, how they come out of prison with many more issues and many more challenges than they entered the prison, and with no appreciable difference in terms of access to resources. In fact, more likely greater difficulty accessing resources because now they have criminal record and they accumulated prison time. And so in addition to all of the other issues that go along with that, just the very clear reality of, having to get out, set up accommodation, feed themselves. And if they had children, try to regain access to those children. Many of those children end up in state care. And, one of the horrendous realities is state will then pump resources into the care of those children when they're in foster care or social services that they won't provide to the mother when she's struggling to survive in the community. And so we have, many areas where we need to be seeing some changes, but fundamentally need to be insisting, I think, that we stop this rush to incarcerate. And we just have to look to what's happening in California and other states where states are going bankrupt because they're putting so many people in prison and sucking the resources out of other areas of the state, particularly education and healthcare. And social services have long been quite abysmal in many states. But they're not only doing that and bankrupting the state, but then being taken to court and found to be putting individuals in what amount to cruel and inhumane and in some cases tortuous prison conditions, particularly if there are people with mental health issues, are being left to languish in segregation.
How optimistic are you that any changes can be affected, given the Tory tough on crime agenda?
Well, there's no doubt that the current legislative agenda of creating longer sentences and more mandatory minimum sentences and depleting the limited abilities that judges do have to use their discretion in sentencing and to not criminalize people is making this a far greater crisis. But one of the things we see is that more and more people are expressing concern about that, and I don't think Canadians are stupid. I don't think people in general are stupid. And when they, hear about this sort of information, they recognize, when people hear women, particularly Indigenous women, are the fastest growing prison population, I think you would be hard pressed to find a person who, when you ask them who they fear when they walk out into the street, it's not going to be hordes of Indigenous women. It's not going to be groups of women generally, usually, And there may be some extreme examples where there, you know, some incidents occur. But by and large, the greatest risk to public safety are not poor, racialized women and women with mental health issues. And yet those are the fastest growing prison population there who are increasingly filling our jail cells, and yet we're not likely to provide those resources in the community. And I think as more and more people hear these, hear this information, as you know, individuals like you try to ensure that there is more public exposure, I think people will start to realize this is not how they want to have, you know, our money spent. It is our money. It's and it shouldn't be being, you know, essentially flushed down the toilet and used in ways that create greater human and social costs long term to us and impact all of us. Impact us whether we are concerned about our own health care, whether we have family members directly impacted. Every single one of us is being impacted by these policies, whether it's through, you know, lack of access to social services, more limited education funds, you know, jeopardizing pensions, jeopardizing, you know, adequate resources generally to live in community.
The report says aggressive action must be taken now to deal with the problem. What would you like to see done?
I think we need to have some immediate action to decarcerate many of the individuals we're talking about. I mean, and this is not a new idea. In the mid-1990s, all the heads of corrections in this country got together, federal, provincial, and territorial, and they, not an advocate, not some a prisoner, but the heads of corrections, all agreed that at that time they could release up to 75% of all the people who were then in prison and not increase any risk to public safety. I dare say that the numbers would be higher now, and particularly for Indigenous women, we could be looking at a presumption of no incarceration, much the way the federal government did when they brought in the new Youth Justice Bill 8 years ago and actually cut in half the number of people in young people in custody. And I think we need to be taking some very clear and direct measures fairly soon. And those resources could be then being reallocated into guaranteed livable incomes, into greater supports and services for women fleeing violence, for rape crisis and women's shelters. And we could be seeing much, much better approaches to not only assisting these women, but reinjecting resources into all of our communities.
Well, Kim, thanks so much for joining us today and discussing this very important report.
Thank you, Sean.
Kim Pate is Executive Director of the Elizabeth Fry Society. The report we've been discussing by the Public Safety Department is called Marginalized: The Aboriginal Women's Experience in Federal Corrections.